This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. So excited for today. We've got Clint Murphy on the program. Not only is he a past guest fan favorite, he's also a partner at Frame, which is a development company in the Lower Mainland and on Vancouver Island.
Yeah.
Super excited to have Clint back on. And I always get really fired up when we have Clint. He's a guy that knows how to motivate.
Would you say he's one of the most purposeful people we've had on the show? Maybe like he's very strategic, but not in a negative way. He does everything with purpose. You know
what I love about Clint is we often have him on at the beginning of the year to set goals, help the VREP community set their goals for the year. And one thing about him is that he knows how to get things done. Like he really like can logically move through the steps and execute, which I think is a hard thing for a lot of people to do. I think a lot of people struggle with that, right? They know where they want to go. They're good at maybe planning the goals, but maybe it's on the execution.
He is a guy who knows how to execute, that's for sure. And he's done it throughout his whole career, which he talks about. The interesting thing about today's conversation is he's not quite as optimistic as he was last time he was on the show. And that was, just over a year. But still very insightful, thinking about how Frame is dealing with the current market conditions, a young company, very strategic, and there's a lot of takeaways still, that's for sure. And I still left kind of fired up.
Yeah.
I still left thinking, I got to strap on the weighted vest. I got to get my weighted vest back on.
Yeah, my weighted vest is in the garage. Here's the thing, Matt. When you think about
did we ask him, does Clint still wear his weighted vest?
I don't know if he still wears his weighted vest. I don't know.
I have to have him back.
Yeah. Now I just wear weight. let's just figure out, because I'm looking at this conversation and how it played out. And I'm thinking we've had a lot of people give their insights on the current state of the market, but also where the problems are in the province, right? And in the region. And then maybe what some of the problems are even at the federal level. And Clint, I find like his analysis is really, really great. And he kind of walks you through. So I think, you know, students of the market, people that are very interested in real estate in the Lower Mainland, there's going to be so much here for you.
He's very good at packaging his information. One of the best, I would say. Him and Woodhouse, would you say?
Very good. Very good.
Very good at packaging and explaining information in kind of very tight, cogent ways. So stay tuned for this. This is a good one.
But before we get to this conversation with Clint, Matt, of course, this episode is sponsored by Scalina Real Estate. And we are sponsoring a segment that remains nameless, but it is a trivia question that covers Vancouver real estate, and sometimes just notable people, musicians. You tend to, you're all over the map.
Yeah, I like to think of myself as the Miles Davis of quiz questions. This one is, we're July 2nd right now. So we just got sales ratios information for June. So I pulled this, looking at May, looking at June, I did a bit of a deep dive. Here's the question for you this week, Adam. We'll see. I know you have not seen the sales data yet. Which detached housing market in Greater Vancouver experienced the largest increase in sales ratio from May to June 2025? Was it West Van, North Van, East Van, or the west side of Vancouver? That's which detached market, that single family homes, Adam, experienced the largest increase? And do you see, historically, I would say you don't usually see an increase in sales, the ratio from May to June. Mm-hmm. But one of these markets stood out.
Wow. I haven't looked at the data yet. So this is a tricky one for me. I'm going to say...
Before we get to that, Adam, why don't we talk about one of our listings over at SkleenaRealEstate.com, but also at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, yeah, where we feature all of our listings.
Yes,
this one's super exciting.
I love this one. It's a 3441 Porter Street. Of course, this is our brand new listing right across the street from Trout Lake. This is at Mason by Boffo, built in 2015. Boffo does great work.
And I was saying to somebody at the property,
yes,
and I don't want to put words in Boffo's mouth. I don't think they would build something like this anymore. They're doing master plan communities now.
Yeah.
This is, you're not going to get Boffo quality in a new townhome project.
It's boutique and yeah, it's there's only 10 units, which is kind of cool. But this is, it's a just shy of 1500 square feet with 600 square feet of outdoor space. So you got a 3-bedroom, 2-bath and a rooftop deck with sweeping city and mountain views. This is available. It's listed at $1,498,000.
Can I just say one thing about this property? Because first of all, well, I mean, there's a lot to speak of inside, but I just wanted to highlight rooftop patio.
Yes.
Okay. You got the mountain views. One thing that you don't realize until you're up there is because you're overlooking the park, for some reason, if you're sitting on the rooftop, it's like a green canopy.
Right.
It's an amazing kind of, it's like you're, it's something that you don't really see in the city very often when you're on a rooftop patio. It's very special.
You know what though? The other and last thing I'll just say about the Trout Lake experience, because yeah, I feel like Trout Lake as an amenity is, it's worth just
second
being
to
as
none.
Close. Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got the farmer's market, you've got the community center, you got the beach, you got the biking and walking trails. You've got everything right there. Then you got the, you know, the dog parks, everything else.
Yeah.
But it's all right. You can spend, like, how many days could you spend there with the kids?
Well, not, and then you don't even get me started on Commercial Street and all the rest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Collective Goods, by the way. Have you been there yet?
Say more.
No, it's a pretty good beef tenderloin. I think it's a tenderloin. Anyways, it's a good spot.
Reminds us of the address, Adam.
Yes, 3441 Porter Street. Matt, and now for the trivia question.
Well, wait, I just wanted to say it's at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Check yes, it out. I haven't seen the rooftop patio deck, but that green canopy, I'm telling you. Yeah. While you're there, click sell with us. You can download the sold plan that start on launch date. It's our most downloaded PDF of all time. It helps you get your property ready for market. It's free. It's an immediate download. Sell with us at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. So let's get back to this question, Adam. This is about the detached housing market.
Yes.
We're talking month over month change. Which of these markets saw the largest increase in sales ratio?
I'm going to go with D, the West Side.
The West Side. So Adam, you're wrong with the West Side. Okay. This is, but the West Side went from a sales ratio of 7% to 9%. So there was a 2% increase on the West Side. So we're going to take that out. Now you have three left. West Vancouver, North Van, or the East Side. Which detached housing market performed better than the West Side at a 2% increase?
Oof. I mean, I'm going to have to go with, I feel like North Van has been outperforming in general. So I feel like this has got to be something that's, I'm going to go East Side.
Ooh. Switch up. I was going to say, you were onto something with North Van. In May, it had a 22% sales ratio overall, yes, in the detached market. Luckily, you didn't choose it though, because it's down 5% at 17. Okay.
Wow.
East Side was at 11% in May. It's up to 14%. It's our winner with an increase of 3%.
Wow.
So the East Side is...
Is that
dramatic? Well, it isn't dramatic, but two are down. West Vancouver and North Vancouver, the sales volume, or not sales volume, I should say the sales ratio are down 2% and 5% respectively. Vancouver though is up, East Side and West Side, but the East Side slightly edging out the West Side.
Wow. Okay. Well, hey, you heard it here first.
This might be the only place you hear it.
Yeah. From the Prince of Darkness of Data. Of multiple choice questions. Matt,
By the way, Clint Murphy actually said he really liked this segment that remains nameless. So we'll see. Maybe after this week, he'll change his mind.
At least someone's getting them right, I guess. But all right, without further ado, our conversation with Clint Murphy.
Enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been nominated for Multifamily Builder of the Year for 10 consecutive years and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with two fitness areas, three children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
Okay, so we're here with Clint Murphy, partner at Frame. How you doing, Clint?
I am doing awesome. You guys probably remember me as the optimistic guy most often on the show. Even I, you know, I've been hearing the tone of the show over the last 5 months and I'm falling in line with the pessimism that's coming along. So looking forward to a bit of a different conversation today, guys.
Should I get into the fetal position now or should I wait till, let's see how it goes first. Yeah,
exactly, 100%.
Well, maybe for people who haven't heard you on the show or need a refresher, because I feel like you've been on in multiple different stages of your career over the last couple of years. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So Vancouver is where I'm raising my family. So the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast really resonates. It's one that the whole family listens to, two boys around 14 and 17. And I have been in the finance world for 25 years, first 10 on and off with KPMG. And 2010, I pivoted to real estate, spent 3 years with West Group. And then the majority of my time was at Mosaic Homes. I was there for a little over 11 years, most of that as their CFO, Chief Financial Officer. And 1 year ago, I started my own development company with three partners, Frame Properties. We generally go by Frame, and we're primarily focused on two things: developing missing middle homes, predominantly in Victoria, though you will see us coming back to Vancouver in the near future. And the second part is development management services. So anything from back office, finance function to managing through the development permit process and then overseeing the construction process. So we're looking at two schools of business, one work for others, one projects that we're doing for ourselves. And right now we're about 60-40 projects for ourselves versus projects for others.
Clint, maybe before we talk about the market, why go off on your own and start a development company?
You know, sitting down with a past shareholder at Mosaic, he talked about this idea that when you're approaching the early to mid 40s, you start to go through a bit of a reconciliation process. Am I going to work in the role I'm in for the rest of my life or other people? Or do I want to take a shot at on myself? And I was at the stage where taking a shot on myself and saying, hey, I want to build something that has my own vision that I could put my own stamp on, my own team, my own partners, and my own culture. And that was the time to do it or not do it. And so I sat down with one of my partners who was leaving Mosaic. And when I asked him what he was doing, he explained business, he explained who he was doing it with. And it really resonated to me and said to him, do you guys want a fourth partner? And started the conversation over the next 6+ months before I made the decision to leave Mosaic and join them. So it was the what felt like, guys, what felt like the right time and the right place to make that decision.
Well, I remember, I think last time you were on the show, we had a conversation around, you know, kind of forging the business in a fairly difficult environment as being a kind of positive at the starting point. So you're not kind of fat and loose. You're like lean.
100%.
Come out of the gate, a lean, mean fighting machine. Is that still your take? Or are you kind of like, all right, well, we've been through the lean year. Can we move on to something else?
I think the general premise is if you're going to start a real estate development company, you're best off to start it at the bottom of the cycle. And the general premise there is you're building at the bottom, you're buying land at the bottom, and you're putting your team and your processes together when things are tough, so that as things improve, as the market comes back, as people start buying again, you're poised for growth, and ideally you have land under contract at cheap prices with good terms so that you can take advantage of it as the market returns. So absolutely the right idea. The one downside is, as a number of people have said on the show in the past, originally it was survive to 25, and once the tariffs started to kick in, and then the election, and then the GST pause, which still hasn't been resolved, which froze the market. We just crossed the two out, and now it's survived 25. And so you thought we were at the bottom. Signs of optimism coming into January. And then I'd say the last 3 or 4 months have just been frozen. The right product in the right locations for the right people are still going to sell. But in general, there's a malaise in the market. And I think a friend of the business and a friend of us personally, Sonny, was on the show recording with you guys just recently. And that was a message that he echoed from the Tandem perspective, is end users in specific locations with the right product for those locations are still going to buy. But it's a very specific person. So I would say that's the shift in the mindset is... we didn't expect at the time that the bottom would be as sustained as it has been. So that's where the challenge is.
I'm just thinking, is there a one kind of lesson learned over the last year since you've been out on your own, or a big takeaway so far in this relation to the market?
Gosh, that's an interesting one. The amount of lessons learned is huge, right? Because every mistake you make, you file away and you say, okay, we can't make that mistake again. And the number one thing for me is a concept I've always used, right? Plan for the best, prepare for the worst. And the amount of contingency that you have, if anything, the last year has taught perhaps contingency on top of contingency with a side of contingency. And what happens when you do that is one of the challenges is you can't really buy dirt, right? Because if you're too contingent, if you're too worried, if your revenues are too low and your costs are too high, you're not going to be competitive. So how do you balance the conservatism that protects you when things go wrong with we need to buy dirt. We need to build homes. We need to sell them. We need to grow. And so that's the fine line of how certain we are in our numbers. And that certainty is getting that certainty and getting to that certainty as soon as possible. And then all we can do, guys, is we can only control what we can control, right? We can't control that we shut off immigration we announced changes to GST rules, which no one knows are happening. We can't control our friend down south deciding that we're going to end the relationship we've had for generations, and we're going to install tariffs that don't make sense. We can't control an election that comes out of nowhere with possibly a change or lack of change that we might have wanted, which I'm sure we'll get into. So we can't control any of that. But we need to make sure that what we can control, we're really on top of.
It's interesting because before you mentioned that last part about the various things that are happening right now in the market, it's, you know, my question was it the tariffs that kind of, because at the beginning of the year, you're right, there was some momentum and it felt like this was going to be a good year for the market, a better year for pre-sale. And it seems like the shift really happened with the announcement of the tariffs, but it sounds like you're seeing this more as a series of kind of unfortunate events that have kind of shaped the market and put us in this place.
Yeah, a big theme of what we'll talk about today as it relates to what caused that slowdown. And also when we talk about some of the challenges that we see in the development world that I don't think government focuses on enough. And what I see is the compounding effect. So when we look at, okay, tariff announcement brings uncertainty. Investors don't like uncertainty. Buyers don't like uncertainty. People don't like the uncertainty of not knowing whether the tariffs are going to impact their job. Will there be layoffs? Will they be able to afford the new home? So that's one thing. Then you start to resolve that uncertainty, right? You go through the uncertain phase. You think you're coming to the certain phase, and then we announce an election. Shit, more uncertainty. So now we piled tariff uncertainty. We piled election uncertainty on top of the tariff uncertainty. And then throughout the election, both parties make different promises as it relates to real estate and what they're going to do. You're both realtors. You have clients, right? Clients are looking to buy a home. They're looking to buy a home under $1 million. Given the announcements that the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party made, wouldn't it be your fiduciary responsibility to say to your client, hey, let's not buy right now. You might get a $50,000 reduction in 4 months. Why don't we wait? So now you have that uncertainty. So you're piling uncertainty on top of uncertainty, on top of uncertainty. And you're doing it all individually without adding the repercussion. And then you shut off immigration. So for the first time ever, what I believe is happening is this year will actually be net negative migration. Mm. And so when you pile that one on, now you look at what's happening in Toronto. There's no one to close on these homes or rent them. Vancouver has that a little bit less than Toronto, or a lot less than Toronto. And then what we see in Victoria is even more muted relative to Vancouver. It's still impacting it, but it's more muted because Victoria isn't driven necessarily by immigration from other countries. Victoria is more driven by, hey, I'm retiring in Quebec and I don't want to move to Florida, so I'm going to go live in the warmest spot in Canada. I'll live in Victoria, or I'll move from Alberta to Victoria. So that's more the driver there.
You know, I'm just thinking about, because I had lunch with a friend of the show in the development world recently, and his comment was that they had a rental building that's that has basically had zero vacancy for, you know, the past 8 years or so that they've owned it. And now they're having a tough time. They've got a lot of vacancies. And his point was the rental market. And I mean, it's quite obvious. Like, we've talked a lot about on the show about rents coming down. There's a lot of sitting inventory in the rental market. You'll see if you go on any, you know, PadMapper, for example, or Facebook Marketplace, you're seeing landlords giving incentives like 2 to 3 months free rent to get places rented for what's probably still down 15% from, you know, peak rent times in some cases. So, you know, I guess my question is what is the rental market doing? And is this the beginning of more challenging times in the rental market ahead?
It depends on the angle and the lens you look at it. And this, to me, is such a crux of what we're seeing online and in social media and all the hate or Gregor Robertson's answer to the new question around affordability. Do prices have to drop for homes to be affordable? His simple answer, no, got crucified, right? He got crucified for that answer. Then you ask Mark Carney the same question, and he says, it's not a simple answer. It's nuanced. It's layered. So the first half of the question to me is rental. Because rental to me is where we generally deal with affordability in the easiest way. And rents have become unaffordable. So when we see rents start to come off, I think the city starts to become more affordable. And I expect that the first thing Gregor and the housing portfolio will do is try to continue to build rental stock in order for rents to come down, while trying to somehow at the same time stabilize the value of for sale homes, condos, townhouses. And one of the reasons they recognize that they have to do that is we can't build homes if prices are falling. And we'll get into that next. We cannot build homes with prices falling, which has a worse long-term impact on Canada. So if we look at rents, my expectation is that for the short term, we will continue to see rent fall as product comes online. So we have three towers being built on the Sinnock lands. We have PCI now renting up their tower on Granville and Broadway. So that's a lot of homes coming available. And I expect that'll put some pressure on downward rents. Where I expect it to stabilize is what we were about to jump in at the start of the show. We were talking about all of the applications for projects in the Broadway corridor. And so many people look at those and say, that's a lot of product coming. But the reality, when you talk to mortgage brokers who are working with people to potentially secure either MLI Select or RCFI financing, they'll suggest to you that up to 75% of those applications will never get built. And there's two drivers of that, guys, that we can dive into if you want to dive into those.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, the first one is exactly what you guys just said, is the rents. So my understanding talking to a number of those brokers is that a lot of those applications are underwriting rents in about the $6 per square foot territory. And what are you guys seeing rents at today?
Yeah, more like
$6 a foot.
Not $6 a foot. I'm thinking more like around $4 a foot.
Yeah, and so people like to say five, and talking to a friend in the industry, he said, yeah, we always hear that five, and it's probably like we rented the penthouse and the top two floors at five, and then the building blended to like a 425 or a 450. Yeah. And then that 450, to your point, has become probably 4.25 or four. And so when you look at five was kind of the high watermark, a little over five on a blended basis, and that's probably come down to about 450. I mean, they need a 30% run in order to hit their $6, or they need to contribute substantially more equity to make a go of the project. So you're likely not going to see a lot of those projects go forward. So why then are they in the application process? One, guys, these application processes take years. When they started these processes or they bought this dirt, the market was great. The market was going up. The market wasn't in a spot where we are today. So they've been hit by the uncertainty that's compounded over the last 3 years. A lot of them probably got these sites going in the development application process pre the interest rate run-up, as an example. That's one. Number two, previously the rules on the Broadway corridor, they had the rule about only two towers per block. And so everybody tried to race each other to get theirs to be one of the towers. My understanding is that rule has now been removed in certain of the areas around transit, et cetera. So there's no longer the, hey, we're only going to do two towers per city block. So now it doesn't have to be a race to say, well, I've got to get mine in. Otherwise, you'll apply and I won't get to build a tower.
Can we just go back to this idea of, I just want to make sure I understand this. You're saying for affordability in the country, rents need to fall, but hopefully home prices stabilize because we need home prices to at least be stable in order to build new housing. Is that right?
To some extent. So I believe that there's a finite period where you can have the two be individually distinct until they start to impact each other. And maybe it's mental gymnastics, but I'll throw the concept at you, right? So the first is affordable rental. An affordable rental is prescriptive. And it doesn't necessarily compete with market rental because affordable rental is product that's coming through the RCFI program or it's coming through the MLI Select program. There's very specific rules on what the rents can be, how they relate to market, which means that your for sale product is not necessarily competing with that product. Because if you're building an MLI Select building, you can't sell it for a period of time, right? You're generally, for that RCFI product, you're generally putting a covenant on title. I can't sell this for 10 years without incurring challenges, right? So to that extent, that market rental product that you're building, also different spec, right? You're generally not quite as high a spec as a for sale product. So that product that's being built for the rental community shouldn't impact the value of for sale product. Now, at some point, if you build enough of it that the rents for affordable drop substantially, they will start to impact market rents. And when you start to impact market rents, you start to bring down the value of the market rental condos. If you continue to do that for a long enough time, likely the for sale values start to drop as well.
Yeah, because it's just so much cheaper to rent, right?
Yeah, because it's so much cheaper to rent, you're not going to buy, right? Once the gap between the two becomes so large, you're not going to buy. So what are you going to buy? That drops the price of the condo. So then you say, well, if the floor is dropping, because we've always talked about, when I've joined you guys, we've talked about this idea of bands, right? We have the band for apartments, we have the band for townhomes, then we have the band for homes. When the discrepancy between the three move, that's where you really start to see almost like an elasticity between them where it's, okay, well, the apartments are dropping now because rent's so cheap, you're not going to buy an apartment, you're just going to rent. So the value of the apartments is dropping. And at what number does it drop before it starts to pull down townhouses? Because now, well, I'm not going to jump from an apartment to a townhouse because the jump's too big. So townhouses have to start dropping. But each of those bands has its own unique supply-demand equation. Because the gap between the apartment and the townhouse now might be getting bigger. Where's the townhouse product? There's not that many townhome sites in the city above certain sizes. So can it really be tied to that apartment value? Can your single family home, when no new single family homes are being built in Vancouver, in the GVA, right? It doesn't make sense. There's no land for it. So at what point will apartment declines drop townhomes, drop single family home? That's what I don't know.
You know, one of the questions that I had that it speaks to it a little bit is, you know, well, the question was, has the new construction market changed for good? Because this is slow market right now, or a frozen market, or is this a full-scale shift in the model for building new homes? And just the reason I bring this up now is just thinking about rents. Like, you know, if rents are declining, it's hard to imagine building a condo tower and getting a lot of those units pre-sold by end users, right? If investors are not buying them, like that doesn't,
that's right.
It also impacts the pre-sale market. So do you think there's there has to be a shift in the model. Have you thought about that at all? Is it, I don't know. I'm just talking off the top of my head here.
Yeah. And like, do concrete towers make sense anymore with the unit composition that we've seen in the past?
In the short term, no. In the short term, I mean, let's look at what we're seeing in the industry, right? We saw Rennie lay off 30% of their workforce and do it vocally. And in doing that, what's the number one type of product that they tend to sell? It is large pre-sale tower condo, right? And so if they're doing that, they're saying, hey, we don't see much of that launching. When you look around the city at the developers, you are seeing some success spots, right? And they talked about that last week. We know a local developer launched in the Tri-Cities in Poco, and they did a tower right on the border of Port Coquitlam and Coquitlam and hit about 150 pre-sales. Now, my understanding is some of the messaging around that was cheaper than resale, pre-COVID pricing. So they drew the price way back, 15 to 20% less than an earlier phase of the same project. I do understand that the project that I believe he was referencing, they may have got increased density based on the TOD rules. And so they were able to say, hey, even at the lower price, we're still making money. So a bit of a different equation, right? But they attacked that through price. Guys, most developers can't do that, right? You bought land, assuming a certain revenue. You went through the development process, assuming a certain revenue. And when you can't achieve that revenue, you're going to press pause. So what does that do to the market, right? Because here's the biggest problem we have with this entire discussion around prices need to fall. One, homeowners don't have to sell. That's predominantly who owns most of the land that we end up developing. Homeowners don't have to sell. Banks don't have to lend. Developers don't have to build. And most of the development sites in the city are controlled by, you know, let's call it 5 to 10 developers in the city. If they can't develop their sites profitably, they're not going to develop. If they can't develop profitably, they're not going to buy new sites. And so that's one of the most startling tells is if you look at site acquisitions in 2024, 2025, there's some developers I know in this city who are some of our biggest developers who haven't bought sites since 2022. What does that do to our pipeline in 2025, 2026, 2027? If it takes 5 years from acquisition to closing and people stop buying in 2022, we are in for a very rough 2026, 2027, 2028. And if people are being very vocal about it right now, and very minimal acquisitions in 2024 and 2025, that means 2029 and 2030 are bad. So we're going to have 5 years with undersupply.
Mm-hmm.
If immigration comes back on, we get more certainty in the economy, please, for the love of all that's holy, liberals, actually do what you said during the election. We'll have a little build. If that goes well and the economy is working, and people have jobs and we have certainty, there are not going to be homes for those people to buy. And the problem is that's when you have a run-up in pricing that otherwise you could have avoided by simply steadying prices and allowing developers to build. The other problem is they are putting in so many rules and policies that are preventing us from being able to build.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Events Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new tennis center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Just before, you know, one thing that, you know, we should talk about that, the challenges of building right now and why some of the most qualified people in Vancouver to build new homes are not buying land to do so at this point. You know, just in terms of house prices coming down with those people who bought pre-sales in 2021, 2022, because I feel like we haven't talked that much on the show. And I don't know about in POCO, Coquitlam border, if everyone had closed on that first tower, if they'd all moved in and got their financing. So like, what is this, the kind of cannibalizing your own projects and really messing with hundreds of people's, and that's just in one building, hundreds of people's ability to close. Like, how does this play out, I guess, especially in the, with the idea that, you know, Gregor Robertson's attacked for not wanting home prices to come down, because that strikes me as something that could just be a disaster if nothing's appraising.
Yeah, and we're seeing that in Toronto play out right now, right? Where they're saying that so many people are having trouble closing on their homes, the banks aren't giving them mortgages because they're underwater. And, you know, I always say, well, the bank will give them a mortgage if they have enough equity in. But the amount of equity that has to go in, a lot of these people don't have it. And so you start to end up with the challenge of people losing their deposits. Developers may go after them to close on the contract, even beyond just losing their deposit. In that case, people potentially going bankrupt because they're not able to close on the homes. You know, we're not the United States. You can't just hand the keys back and walk away. So it presents a real challenge to the market if you can't close on the homes. I think luckily in Vancouver, the number of homes that are completing that are going to be in this situation is lesser than Toronto. I think there will be an impact. And most of these homes probably are still 2-3 years away from completing. If they were pre-selling at the peak, let's say the peak was mid-2022, June 2022 roughly, right? If they were concrete and they were pre-selling then, they likely got into the ground a year later. And so mid-2023, and then there are 3 years to build or more. So we're talking mid-2026 to mid-2027. So if there's some resolution between now and then, we could be okay with those closings, or it will present a similar challenge to Toronto. You know, the last thing you want to see, I don't know if you guys remember the early to mid-thousands. I remember my wife and I had just been married, 04. We went to New York for our honeymoon. We went down to Miami, or we did a cruise that took us through Miami. And you saw towers that were like 50% built, and then they just stopped.
Yeah.
And it was an area that was a bit of a ghost town of like half completed towers for about a decade before the market came back. And then everything, you know, started chugging along again. So the question becomes, how do we adjust policy and in a way that doesn't see us have a decade of lost building?
I think we should get to that. But I want to go back just quickly to, I'm thinking about the big developers in the Lower Mainland and in BC, and I'm thinking about the next few years. Like, clearly they have to keep building, they have to keep, you know, employees working and keep moving forward. If they're not building in Vancouver, if they're not acquiring, like, do we run the risk? Like, where do we see the energy spent by large developers in Vancouver? Are they going to look in other markets? Are they going to pivot to rental? Like, do you see generally speaking, where are the big players going to move to in your mind?
So the number one way they adjust locally is they pivot product type. So we go back earlier to that conversation you had with Sunny from Tandem. End users, the right product in the right locations. And if we can't pre-sell a condo, then we have to build something that we can build on spec. That's generally going to be wood. You're generally going to be looking at six-story apartments. You're going to be looking at, let's call it 4 to 6 story wood frame apartments. And you're going to be looking at townhouse sites. Because for the right developer of the right size, those sites can get built without pre-sales. And so the bank is going to say, hey, Polygon, hey, Concert, Ani, Mosaic, we're going to let you get started on this 100 unit wood frame project, recognizing that when it's done in 3 or 4 years, given your track record, given your experience, given the product type, given the location, given what we're seeing in the market without the pre-sale condo, there's going to be an appetite to buy those homes. So what you're seeing and in what you will see more of is homes being built without pre-sales. That locks out smaller players.
Yeah, of course.
That works for the big guys. That works for the big balance sheets. That works a lot less for the smaller players.
I guess there's an argument to be made that we're leaving a lot of inventory on the table. I mean, this goes the potential of building new inventory. And I mean, this goes back to the lack of construction we're going to see over the next 5 or 6 years here. But if we move to now kind of ground-oriented, smaller developments, I can't imagine what amount of housing we're leaving on.
The volumes drop substantially, 100%.
Right. Son.
Yes. So you build, I mean, it's almost the same. It's almost the same impact as tariffs, right? When you have tariffs, the costs get passed on to the consumer to the extent that they can be passed on. And then some has to get eaten because the consumers are going to buy less. So they're going to buy less, but they have to pay more for what they do buy. That's what happens with the housing. Because we're going to build less, but because there's less, now the supply-demand economics don't work again. So you're going to have to pay more because you're going to compete with more people for less product. So those who are able to build into that period where other people aren't building, on the other side of it, they'll have less competition. That will bring prices back up, which ought to allow building to commence again.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to, this is something that maybe is a diversion here a little bit, but I was kind of curious, is that the management services that you're doing at Frame, is that the strategy? It seems like an obvious strategy right now in order to keep the lights on and kind of scale through this market is to you know, work with others as well. Is that kind of the logic there?
Totally accurate. So you look at our model and you say, well, hey, like, everything you've just described, like if you're that startup developer, like how does that work? So it's two things. One is we specifically bought our sites in a way that allows us to operate even in these conditions. So that's a couple things. One, we bought with very long timelines, right? So we want to get on the other side of the uncertainty during the hold period. Two, because of our size, we bought sites that are of a scale that a bank will let us start without the pre-sales. So generally what we'll do is called a tranched financing. So the first tranche will let us start construction, let's say with a 70% loan to cost, so we'll just throw out rough numbers. And then when we hit a certain level of pre-sales, they'll tranche us up into tranche two, which will take us let's say 80% loan to cost. So that 10%, if we're doing 19 townhomes, let's call it a 15 million build, that 1.5 million is just extra equity we need until we can get to their pre-sale target. And because we now can get under construction and we have a 2-year construction period, we can sell slowly over that construction period. And as soon as we hit their number, our equity drops and they put more money in the deal. But we can start. And if the market's not great, we can just keep building through it because we've already got our equity in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's finding the sites that allow us time to get to the other side and then structuring the deal with our financial partners in a way that allows us to get going even without the pre-sales and then improve the financial metrics with the pre-sales. That's one, making sure that we target the right development size projects that are bite-sized that we can chew on that can allow us to grow, but do at risk. It's always risk respectfully. The other side of the equation is, I'll give you some examples of shops that have done this in a way that I really admire. You look at West Group, you look at Cressy, they've built very large income portfolios. Those income portfolios allow them to support their development business even when the market's not great. Because now the net operating income, the NOI from their development or their income business supports the development business when the fees aren't covering the overheads. So they don't necessarily have to do layoffs that a pure developer would. Mm-hmm. But we're a startup. We're not going to build a big rental business. So then look at, as an example, a sponsor of the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast, you look at Marcon. For 25 to 30 years, predominantly known as one of the best builders or construction companies in Vancouver. I would say, and they may have that entire time been doing projects on their own. But I think if the three of us looked at each other, you would say, well, they were a builder. Now, no one would say that, right? They're one of the biggest developers in the city. Developers, builders, and now they're also a big player in the rental world. And so while they built their business, they were always able to support the team through construction management services. And so I look at their model and say, well, I'm not a construction guy. I'm not going to have construction management services, but we're developers and we really understand development and we understand all aspects of it, from the financing to the development permit, building permit, construction management process, from land acquisition all the way to we're handing keys to a homeowner. So can we build the business in a way where we're always providing a certain level of development management services? And to me, the math is 30 to 50% of our business into perpetuity being in that arena. Because then we're always... If you look at it conceptually, it's interesting that when you look at the finance back office, when you look at development managers, most shops will tell you that like a development accountant or a development manager can do between 3 and 4 projects. Well, if one of those 4 projects is for a third party, the revenue we're generating from doing that project for the third party covers the cost of that labor for the colleagues. Now, any project we do on our own, the fee revenue should be surplus. So if we're always doing 25 to 45% of projects for others, we should always be in a fee surplus. We should always be able to keep the lights on. And then we can get into, well, for the person who you're providing those services, like, what's the downside? Because wait a second, you're a competing developer. But we can talk about like why that actually is a bonus to them, not a detriment.
So it sounds like you're not, this is an ongoing kind of component. This isn't just the nature of this market. You've kind of pivoted. This is kind of management services is a strategy in perpetuity.
Yeah, when you asked me what one of the biggest lessons learned over the last year was, that was the biggest lesson is that we have to build in a way that allows us to be sustainable through any market situation. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's going to become a three-pronged strategy. Is the sooner we can get into rental and can have sufficient capital to build a rental portfolio, I want us to be doing that. Even if in the short term, it means slightly less growth than we otherwise would have had because we're not cycling that capital, I want to get rental income into our hands. I want to be providing development management services to others. And I think we have a very strong team doing that on the development side. My partner Hassan is phenomenal at this process and taking from concept through to, hey, here's what we're ultimately going to build. And what he's put together with a great architecture team on the Regal Beagle as an example is a great testament to that. So rental, development management services, and then for-profit development. If we can over the next, you know, and I love the idea, we joked about it, but this is the 1 year mark is sort of that annual update with you guys. If over the next 20 years, we end up in that spot where we have a decent rental portfolio, we're still doing managed services, and we have our own reasonably sizable development business, it's the best of all worlds. That should allow us to survive in any market, up, down, left, right.
Clint, I'm just thinking, and I mean, we kind of touched a little bit on policy earlier, but you know, there's been a lot of changes to housing legislation, like you know, Bill 44 and 47, kind of unlocking density. But now the market is not facilitating the build out. What needs to change at a policy level?
What needs to change is we need to have a wholesale look at every change, right? Because you're saying changes. But let's go down the list, right? Markets at a peak mid-2022, and they started raising DCCs and CACs at that time that were making development unsustainable. So now let's take revenues down 10%. Have you guys seen anyone from any municipality come out and say, hey, maybe we should lower our DCCs? So that's one. The other is we're going back to the compounding effect. So in the last 2 to 3 years, some changes that are coming in, we have changes to the step code requirements. We have increasing requirements for seismic capacity. They wanted to believe it got deferred, but we have changes to adaptability requirements that basically on any condo would add about 50 square feet to the size of the unit that you're trying to build. We have increasing DCCs across the Lower Mainland and the island. We have areas like Victoria instituting new water and sewer charges. We have, with the implementation of some of these new bills, it allowed them to now charge what are called, it's another word for CACs, they call it ACCs, amenity contribution charges, which same thing. So now we have increased ACCs. So you look across the board, and whenever you ask anyone about any one of those six things, and if you bring another developer on the show, they'll probably throw four more at you. Whenever they bring one of them, they tell you about how they modeled it. But has anyone modeled all six? Because it doesn't work. And I'll give you guys an example because this one just blew me away, right? Victoria has spent the last few years. Love the team there. Love working with council and staff. But this is really interesting to me, is they've spent years building this new OCP. The idea being, let's change all of, like we have like, I think they have something like 200 different zones across the city. And they're like, let's have one. Let's have one. So you know exactly what you can build, where you can build it. They came up with this idea of different town centers, hubs, right? And you can do this here, you can do that there. And what is one thing they all want? They kind of want you building with wood. because it's more carbon neutral, better for the environment. And there's this idea of, hey, generally, if you're under four stories in your wood, you can build it. Great idea. And in these city hubs, you can kind of be in that 6 to 12 stories. If it's wood, great. Adam Cooper from Abstract, he might have been the one who did this. They overlaid the seismic requirements, put them on a map with the different soil conditions, and they overlaid it on top of the desired OCP. And almost every one of those hubs has soil conditions that won't actually allow us to build the product they want us to build. Like basically it renders wood frame 6-story, 4 to 6-story wood frame, not built. You can't do it. It's economically unviable. And you overlay the soil conditions of almost every one of those desired hubs, dead. So you just say, like, who at what level is having the conversation to say, maybe we should all talk together. Maybe federally, provincially, and municipally, we should get on the same page. What should developers be paying? What should they be building? And can we just have a moratorium on change for like a decade? Like we have enough change. And if we built everything to the level that we were building 5 years ago, I don't think anyone would complain. But they just want so much evolution in such a short time frame, and all of it costs money.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, I just thinking, I mean, we've kind of touched on the election at the federal level a little bit. Is it too soon to have a take on that, Clint? Or do you have, what are your thoughts?
It's nuanced, right? It's, you know, I'm probably not the only developer to come on here and say, hey, I would have preferred for the conservatives to win. We were seeing policy over the last decade that hasn't been good for our economy. And I think Chrystia Freeland, when they were interviewing her and saying, well, what are some of the biggest changes that you would make? I mean, you were Trudeau's right hand. Like, you are Trudeau. Like, everything he did, you did. And Chrystia Freeland was the one who said, I think over the last decade, we've spent too much time on identity politics and virtue signaling. And we haven't spent enough time on building an economy, right? When do people not fight? When are people happier? When do we have less talk about Alberta separation? When do we have less talk about how bad Canada is? We have less talk about any of that. When the economy is doing well, people have jobs, people are making money. They're making more money than costs are going up. They're making enough money that they can buy homes, that they can rent homes, that they can provide a future for their children. So if there's anything we should have been focused on in the last decade, it was building a strong economy that would serve Canadians. So that was a challenge. Now, you're like, well, wait, isn't it the exact same team? So here's the analogy that you guys will probably appreciate. There's been plenty of teams that when you change the coach, they win a cup or they win a Super Bowl. And sometimes all you need to do is change the coach. And a new coach comes in, they have a new message, a new direction, a new vision, and they whip the players and the team into shape. And you go in the right direction. I can only hope, as a Canadian who believes in Canada, who believes in Vancouver, because you guys are probably wondering at this stage of the conversation, why the heck are you still doing what you're doing? I'm doing it because I love and believe in this city, in this province, and in this country in the fullness of time. I think what happened over the last 6 months with the tariffs, with what's going on in the United States, I think posthumously, because by the time we realize it, you know, Donald, I'm not wishing any ill. I'm just saying he's going to be, by the time we realize how good of a thing he did, he'll be in his 90s, that Donald Trump will get an Order of Canada, because it was the wake-up call that our country needed to get back on track and right the ship. Even though I probably voted conservative, I hope that Carney is saying the right things, is speaking the right language. Now we just need to see the, as Danielle Smith said, I don't know if I want to be siding with her on the podcast, but she said Albertans are the type of people that like to see the walk more than the talk. And I'm that same type of person. They're saying the right things. Now we need to see them deliver. What do you guys think?
And we're out of time.
Maybe we'll leave it there, Clint,
for
the fine wire.
Oh, man. Well, we've kept you for an hour, Clint. And I feel like we could do this for another 3 hours, but we're not the Joe Rogan podcast. So we'll try to keep this under an hour. But we do, Matt, any final questions or before
well,
we
I got,
move
I
to
got
the five?
One. I got one maybe, Clint, in order to avoid your question. The first time you were on the show, you had an investment thesis that you put into play in Vancouver. I feel like at a different point you came on and you were talking about how that investment thesis had changed. Is there an investment thesis for Vancouver real estate right now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. For me personally, the investment thesis now has become purely frame, right? And building the business. I think my thesis, and as part of frame, is taking a page out of Peter Wessick's playbook, right? And Peter's been doing this with West Group, for those who don't know Peter. Peter's been doing this since the early 80s, first with Park Lane Homes and then eventually with West Group. And if you talk to Peter about what he did and how he did it and why he did it, he would say that he had an unwavering belief in the long-term potential and viability of this city, province, and country, which is roughly what I said a few minutes ago. And so his message was, given that's the way I feel, I want to buy as much of it as I possibly can. And I always want to be buying it. I don't have the capital to be doing that playbook yet, but that's the playbook of building the development business, building the development management service business, and building the rental portfolio. The idea is people will always want to live here. I always joke with global warming, we simply are becoming a nicer version of California. You know, it might suck for places where they don't have water, we have forests, et cetera. You know, just go down the list. Add 5 degrees. Hey, it's a pretty nice place year round. So I think people will continue to want to live in our city and in our province. And so if you buy with a long-term mentality, so you say, hey, I'm not looking to make a quick buck on an Airbnb. I'm not looking to make quick cash flow in the early years. I'm buying with a 20-year outlook that people will continue to want to move to this city. I think you will still do well in real estate. And like you guys, I still think it's like downtown apartments, but you know, we've been wrong for 6 years.
We have been wrong for 6 years.
Yeah. But it is good. It is. I feel like that cut through the noise, you know, the longer term vision allows you to cut out a lot of the noise. And there's a lot of noise right now. So no, I like that answer. So Clint, maybe we'll leave it there, but we do have this segment that I think you're familiar with called The Five Wire. Do you have time to stick around for that?
Let's do it.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area. Because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure. An all-around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's J-E-T-H-R-O condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours. This is great because I feel like you're one of these, you know, we should shout out the growth guide. I get a lot of recommendations from your growth guide. But the first question, one book you have read recently, and we all know you're a prolific reader, one book you've read recently that you can recommend to our audience.
This one may surprise you in that with moving houses, I shut the podcast off for probably the last 6 months, which means, interestingly, I, to some extent, stopped reading nonfiction and started dipping back into fiction. So I've been going pretty hard at that, which has been a fun experience because I put that away for 3 years. I'm going to say that one of the best books I've read recently would be, there's an author named James Islington, and he started a new fantasy series. The name is escaping me right now, but it's a fantasy series that's kind of built a bit on Roman world, and that's been enjoyable. For those who are listening who may pan reading fiction, apparently it increases your emotional intelligence. So highly recommend that people supplement their nonfiction with fiction.
Okay. All right. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life? And I feel like, again, if we're going back to rucksacking?
We've had some fun ones.
15 different really interesting ones. So,
you know, I would say the one that's really jumping out at me, and I'm starting to put it into practice again, is this idea of we are what we repeatedly do. Quote by Aristotle, which is one of my favorite quotes. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence then is not an act, but a habit. And I'll be writing about this for a newsletter this week. And it's this idea of rhythm and routine, right? And I tend to be the type of person that when I fall out of rhythm and routine, I'm done. And so I've got to redesign my rhythm and routine and then get on top of it. Running, walking, weightlifting, diet. And just making sure, like dialing in each of those dials so that the net end result matches the desired outcome.
Love it. It's a good one. Binge watching or favorite movie? Something you've seen in the last year since we saw you last.
Yeah. So I'm going to throw a quiz at you. Whenever you're watching live TV, like, which is rare nowadays, right? But let's say you are watching something on demand. What's the TV show that you almost always see a commercial for? Involves cops. We've been seeing ads for that show for years, and our son got into it. So we started binge watching it every night when we lay in bed. We'll watch an episode or so and just love it. It's great.
What happened, right? Like, I feel like sometimes if I sit down, I'll watch like Matlock or something if I can find it. Like, those shows are really fantastic. And I feel like with streaming, they went away, right? Because on demand, like created, I don't know, it seemed like there was pressure to watch something that was quote unquote really good as opposed to something that you could just kill an hour. But I feel like
you can just kill an hour.
All those really old, just good
CSI
shows.
Yeah. Like you have a bit of an overarching storyline, but every show is uniquely distinct. It's not like this, like basically they turned TV into like 6 to 12 hour movies where you had to like know what happened last episode.
You have to pause to leave. Whereas like NYPD Blue, you're like, hey, I missed
just walk out of the room.
15 minutes.
Who cares? Yeah, exactly. we like them as background noise, right? Like sometimes one of us will walk out. My wife will be like, oh, I missed the last 4 episodes. Where am I? And I'll be like, she's like, okay, let's go. Yeah,
you're exactly where you were when you left.
Yeah, exactly. That's what she said yesterday. Yeah, love it.
All right, I'll check it out because I'm looking for something that's mindless but entertaining. Music you've been listening to, favorite band? I guess we got to do of the last year, something you've been listening to in the car.
I have now. I've moved on to this one in the last few weeks. My son, I've been borrowing his gaming laptop occasionally to play a little Call of Duty. And he has a soundtrack called Songs to Listen to While Playing Valorant, which is like a first-person shooter young kids play. Yeah. And it's got like great soundtracks that you can play in the background while you're playing a first-person shooter or you're just putzing around the house. So Songs to Listen to While Playing Valorant. That's my new playlist.
Is that his playlist or is that
That's his playlist. Well, okay. No, it's not his playlist. It's just one that he's signed up for. So I signed up for it too.
Right on. Okay. Last but not least, and I feel like this is right in your wheelhouse as well. Something you have purchased for under $1,500 in the last year that has had a positive impact on your life.
Right now, that would be my wife bought a nice new coffee maker. Interesting. One of those, we had a great one and it broke after like X number of years. And yeah. You go back to Costco and they just hand you another one. So it might have actually cost zero. But it can do like both the Keurig K-Cups and the Nespresso, like, and the fancier stuff. So I can whip up just a good cup of coffee before walking out the door and she can make a fancy coffee with some frother and we're both happy. So simple coffee machine.
Hey, there's nothing better. Well, that's great, Clint. Thank you again for coming on the show again. And before we went live, we were saying, you know, there's a couple of weekly mailers I get that I'm sure to open, and yours is one of them. So we should shout out the Growth Guide. It's always great content there. But how can people find out more about Frame, what you're doing, the Growth Guide, keep on top of all things Clint Murphy?
Yeah, I love to put the name of things into the URL. So it's frame.properties is our company website and thegrowth.guide is the personal website. And hopefully for the audience, despite a lot of the negative angles on some of these topics, I remain very optimistic for our city, province, country, and real estate industry in Vancouver. So let's keep winning.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Matt.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Clint Murphy, partner over at Frame, and past guest fan favorite, that is for certain.
Always great having Clint on the show. Tons of takeaways in that conversation. And I feel like that's, you know, Clint also is able to, I think, explain this in a way that hopefully for a lot of our listeners, they'll kind of see, okay, yeah, there's a lot of contradictions kind of happening in how we're trying to solve these problems.
He's definitely, not as much gloss, but a lot of insight, which is what I'm looking for. So I appreciate it.
I'm more glossy. I'm a gloss guy. Anyways, go on, man.
What else do we have before we go for the day? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the Live Wire. This is our weekly mailer where you get those sales ratios. You can dig into those yourself and come up with quiz questions if you'd like. We also have Deal of the Month, VIP access to pre-sales, and of course, tried and true private client services.
And Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, you get days on market, you basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Go sign up for your own free account. I'm telling you, this is the best way to look for real estate in the Lower Mainland. It is your own portal to monitor the market. And a lot of people signing up lately, and I think a lot of people getting a ton of benefits from it, and it's free. So check it out.
Absolutely. If you want to talk about that or anything else, you can try me at 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we have that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We'll have a great week and we're back here next week with another great episode.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.